me, a stranger of the opposite sex, to present him with items pertaining to his bodily functions. And anyway, a tube of toothpaste or a packet of disposable razors did not strike me as very charming gifts. I tried to remember the nicest gift I'd ever received. Apart from Polly the plant, I couldn't think of anything. Alarmingly, Declan came into my mind. My first and only boyfriend. I'd very nearly succeeded in erasing him from my memory altogether, so it was rather distressing to be reminded of him. I recalled an incident when, on seeing the single birthday card I'd received one year from a journalist who'd somehow managed to track me down with a note inside reminding me that she'd pay a substantial sum for an interview any time, anywhere, he claimed that I deliberately hadn't told him the date of my birthday. For my 21st birthday gift, he therefore punched me in the kidneys, kicked me as I lay on the floor until I passed out, and then gave me a black eye when I came round for withholding information. The only other birthday I could recall was my 11th. I received a sterling silver bracelet from the foster family I was living with at the time, with a teddy bear charm attached. I was very grateful to receive a present, but I didn't ever wear it. I'm not really a teddy bear sort of person. I wondered what sort of gift the handsome singer might give me for an anniversary, say, or for Christmas. No, wait, for Valentine's Day, the most special romantic day of the year. He'd write a song for me, something beautiful, and then play it for me in his guitar while I sipped perfectly chilled champagne. No, not on his guitar, that was too obvious. He'd surprise me by learning the bassoon. Yes, he'd play the melody on the bassoon for me. Back to more prosaic matters. For want of anything more suitable, I bought some newspapers and magazines for Sammy, thinking that I could at least read them aloud to him. They stocked a passable selection. From his appearance and the contents of his shopping bag, I divined that Sammy was more Daily Star than Daily Telegraph. I bought a few tabloids and decided to take him a magazine too. That was more difficult. There were so many. Condé Nast Traveller, Yachts and Yachting Now. How would I know which one to choose? I had no idea what interested him. I thought carefully and rationally in order to deduce the answer. The only thing I knew for sure about him was that he was an adult male. Anything else would be pure speculation. I went with the law of averages, stood on tiptoe, and reached up for a copy of Razzle. Job done. It was too hot inside the hospital and the floor squeaked. There was a hand gel dispenser outside the ward, and a big yellow sign above it read, "Do not drink." Did people actually drink sanitizing hand gel? I suppose they must, hence the sign. Part of me, a very small sliver, briefly considered dipping my head to taste a drop, purely because I'd been ordered not to. "No, Eleanor," I told myself, "curb your rebellious tendencies. Stick to tea, coffee, and vodka." I was apprehensive about using it on my hands for fear that it might inflame my eczema, but I did so nonetheless. Good hygiene is so important. Heaven forfend that I would end up becoming a vector of infection. The ward was large, with two long rows of beds, one down each wall. All the inhabitants were interchangeable, hairless, toothless old men who were either dozing or staring blankly ahead, chins slumped forwards. I spotted Sammy, right at the end on the left-hand side, but only because he was fat. The rest of them were bones draped with pleated grey skin. I sat down on the vinyl, wipe-clean chair next to his bed. There was no sign of Raymond. Sammy's eyes were closed, but he obviously wasn't comatose. He would be in a special ward if that were the case, hooked up to machinery, wouldn't he? I wonder why Raymond had lied about it. I could tell from the regular way that Sammy's chest rose and fell that he was sleeping. I decided not to read to him, not wishing to wake him. And so I put the reading material on the top of the cabinet next to his bed. I opened the compartment at the front, thinking it best to deposit the bags for life inside. The cabinet was empty apart from a wallet and a set of keys. I wondered if I should look in Sammy's wallet to see if it contained any clues about him, and I was about to reach forward for it when I heard someone clear their throat behind me, a phlegm-filled sound that indicated a smoker. "Eleanor, you came," said Raymond, pulling up a chair on the opposite side of the bed. I stared at him.
"Why did you lie, Raymond? Sammy's not in a coma, he's merely asleep. That's not the same thing at all."
Raymond laughed. "Oh, but it's great news, Eleanor. He woke up a couple of hours ago. Apparently he's got severe concussion and a broken hip. They reset it yesterday. He's very tired from the anaesthetic, but they say he's going to be fine." I nodded and stood up abruptly.
"We should leave him in peace, then," I said.
I was keen to be out of the ward, to be frank. It was too hot and too familiar. The waffle blankets, the chemical and human smells, the hard surfaces of the metal bed frame and the plastic chairs. My hands were stinging slightly from the gel, which had seeped into the cracks in my skin. We walked together to the lift and rode down in silence. The doors opened at the ground floor and I felt my legs speed up of their own accord towards the front door. It was one of those beautiful midsummer evenings, 8 o'clock and still full of heat and soft light. It wouldn't get dark till almost 11. Raymond took off his jacket, revealing another ridiculous T-shirt. This one was yellow and had two white cartoon cockerels on the front. "Los Polos Hermanos," it said, nonsensical. He looked at his watch. "I'm going to pick up a carry-out and head round to my mate Andy's. A few of us usually hang out there on Saturday nights, fire up the PlayStation, have a smoke and a few beers."
"Sounds utterly delightful," I said.
"What about you?" he asked. I was going home, of course, to watch a television programme or read a book. What else would I be doing?
"I shall return to my flat," I said. "I think there might be a documentary about Komodo dragons on BBC Four later this evening." He looked at his watch again and then up at the boundless blue sky.
There was a moment of silence, and then a blackbird began showing off nearby, his song so spectacular that it bordered on vulgar. We both listened, and when I smiled at Raymond, he smiled back.
"Look, it's far too nice a night to be sitting inside on your own. Fancy grabbing a quick pint somewhere? I'll need to head off in an hour or so before the office shuts, but..."
This required careful consideration. I had not been in a public house for many years, and Raymond could hardly be described as engaging company. I quickly concluded, however, that it would be useful for two reasons. Firstly, it would be good practice, as, if things went well, Johnny Lomond would probably want to take me to a public house during one of our dates, and so I really ought to familiarise myself in advance with the general environs and required behaviours in such establishments. Secondly, Raymond was an IT expert, allegedly, and I needed some advice. Such advice might be expensive to obtain via official channels, but I could ask him tonight, for free. All things considered, it seemed expeditious to accede to Raymond's request. He was staring into the middle distance, and I noticed that he had lit a cigarette and smoked almost half of it while I had been pondering. "Yes, Raymond, I will go to the pub with you for one drink," I said, nodding.
"Magic," he said.
We ended up in a bar 5 minutes from the hospital on a busy road. One of the tables outside was unoccupied. The metal surface was covered in circular stains and its legs looked unstable, but Raymond seemed delighted.
"Seats outside," he said, happily throwing himself down and hanging his jacket over the back of his chair. "Right then, I'll go to the bar," he said. "What are you after, Eleanor?"
I felt a fluttering of concern in my stomach. Firstly, sitting out here, I wouldn't get to see the inside of the public house and observe what went on there. Secondly, I didn't know what to order. What did normal people drink in public houses? I decided to take control of the situation. "Raymond, I will go to the bar. I insist. What would you like me to order for you?" He tried to argue, but I stood my ground and eventually he agreed, although he seemed annoyed. I simply could not fathom why he was making such a fuss about it.
"Right, well, I suppose I'll have a pint of Guinness then. But I wish you'd let me get it, Eleanor."
I put both hands on the table and leaned forward so that my face was very close to his. "Raymond, I will purchase the drinks.
It's important to me for reasons that I don't wish to articulate to you."
He shrugged, then nodded, and I walked off towards the door.
It seemed very dark inside after the sunlight, and noisy too. There was music of an unfamiliar genre pulsing loudly from large speakers. The place wasn't busy, and I was the only customer at the bar. A young man and a young woman were serving. That is to say, they were deep in conversation with each other, and every so often she would giggle like a simpleton and flick her dyed yellow hair, or he would punch her arm playfully and laugh in an overly loud, false manner. Human mating rituals are unbelievably tedious to observe. At least in the animal kingdom, you are occasionally treated to a flash of bright feathers or a display of spectacular violence. Hair flicking and play fights don't quite cut the mustard. I was bored, and I knocked hard, 3 times on the wooden bar, as though it were a front door. They both looked up. I asked for a pint of Guinness, which the boy began to pour from a tap. "Anything else?" he said. I was still stumped. I reasoned that part of his job would be to help customers in such situations. "What would you recommend?" I asked him. He looked up from watching the black liquid trickle into the glass. "Eh?" I said, "What would you recommend for me? I don't drink in public houses, as a rule." He looked to his left and right, as if expecting someone else to be standing there. There was a long pause. He said, "Well, Magners is very popular, with ice. Nice summer drink." "Right," I said, "thank you. In that case, I'll have a Magners drink, please, on your recommendation." He opened a brown bottle and put it on the bar. He put some ice in a tall glass and placed it next to the bottle. "What's that?" I said. "The Magners." "And what's the empty glass for?"
"It's for the Magners," he said.
"Am I expected to pour the drink from the bottle into the glass?" I said, puzzled. "Isn't it your job to do that?" He stared at me and then slowly poured the brown liquid over the ice and put it down quite hard. Indeed, he practically slammed the bottle onto the counter.
£8.70, he said in a most unfriendly manner.
I handed over a £5 note and £4 coins, then took my change and carefully put it in my purse. "Would you by any chance have a tray?" I asked. He tossed down a filthy, sticky tray and watched as I placed the drinks on it before turning his back on me. There is such a paucity of good manners on display in the so-called service sector. Raymond thanked me for the drink and took a big gulp. The Magners was quite pleasant, and I revised my opinion of the young barman. Yes, his customer service skills were poor, but he did at least know how to make appropriate beverage recommendations. Unprompted, Raymond started to tell me about his mother, how he was going to visit her tomorrow, something he did every Sunday. She was a widow, and not terribly well. She had a lot of cats, and he helped her care for them. On and on and on he droned. I interrupted him. "Raymond," I said, "can I ask you something?" He sipped his pint.
"Sure."
"If I were to purchase a smartphone, which type would you advise? I have been looking into the relative merits of iPhones as compared with Android devices, and I'd appreciate an insider's perspective on the cost-benefit ratio, as it were." He looked somewhat surprised at my question, which was odd, given that he worked in IT and therefore must be asked technological questions quite frequently.
"Right, well..."
He shook his head in a slightly canine way, as though he were clearing thoughts from it.
"Well, that depends on a lot of factors."
He expounded on these factors at some length, without reaching any kind of useful conclusion, and then looked at his watch.
"Shit, I better run. I need to pick up some beers before I head over to Andy's, and it's nearly 10.
He drained his pint, stood up and put on his jacket, even though it wasn't in the least bit cold.
"You going to be okay getting home, Eleanor?" he said.
"Oh, yes," I said. "I'll walk. It's such a beautiful evening, and it's still light."
"Right then, I'll see you on Monday," he said. "Enjoy the rest of your weekend."
He turned to leave. Raymond, wait, I said. He turned back towards me, smiling.
What is it, Eleanor?
The Guinness, Raymond. It was £3.50. He stared at me. It's okay, I said. There's no rush. You can give it to me on Monday, if that's easier. He counted out £4 coins and put them on the table.
Keep the change, he said, and walked off. Extravagant.
I put the money in my purse and finished my Magners. Emboldened by the apples, I decided to take a detour on the way home. Yes, why not? It was time for a spot of reconnaissance. Chapter 8. There is no such thing as hell, of course, but if there was, then the soundtrack to the screaming, the pitchfork action and the infernal wailing of damned souls would be a looped medley of show tunes drawn from the annals of musical theatre. The complete oeuvre of Lloyd Webber and Rice would be performed, without breaks, on a stage inside the fiery pit, and an audience of sinners would be forced to watch and listen for eternity. The very worst amongst them, the child molesters and the murderous dictators, would have to perform them. Save for the exquisite oeuvre of a certain Mr. Lomond, I have yet to find a genre of music I enjoy. It's basically audible physics, waves and energized particles, and like most sane people, I have no interest in physics. It therefore struck me as bizarre that I was humming a tune from Oliver. I mentally added the exclamation mark, which for the first time ever was appropriate. Who will buy this wonderful evening? Who indeed? One of the foster carers kept a video library of musicals that we worked our way through en famille at weekends. And so, although I fervently wish that I wasn't, I'm very familiar with the work of Lionel Bart, Rodgers and Hammerstein et al. Knowing I was here on the street where he lived was giving me a funny feeling, fluttery and edgy, verging on euphoric. I could almost understand why that frock-coated buffoon from My Fair Lady had felt the need to bellow about it outside Audrey Hepburn's window. Finding out where the musician lived had been easy. He had posted a picture of a lovely sunset on Twitter. At Johnny Aleworks. The view from my window. How lucky am I? Hashtag summer in the city. Hashtag blessed. It showed rooftops, trees and sky, but there was also a pub in the corner of the photograph, right at the end of the street, its name clearly visible. I found it in seconds, thanks to Google. The street, like most in this part of the city, was made up of tenements. They all had a secure main front door with named buzzers on the outside wall, one for each flat inside the building. This was the right street. Which side should I start with? Even numbers, I decided. He was an even sort of man, not an odd one. I had a puzzle to solve. I hummed as I worked, and couldn't remember the last time I'd felt like this, light, sparkly, quick. I suspected that it might be what happiness felt like. It was fascinating to see all the different names on the buzzers, and the manner in which they were displayed. Some were scribbled in biro on a sticker and placed carelessly over the button. Others had typed their names in bold uppercase, printed it out and affixed it with three layers of sellotape. A few had left their buzzer blank or failed to replace their name when the elements had made the ink run, rendering it illegible. I really hoped he wasn't one of those, but I kept a list of their locations in my notebook just in case. If I had eliminated all the legible names without coming across his, I'd have to go back and work my way through the list of blank ones. Ah, but how could I have doubted him? Halfway down the street, the most even of even numbers, there he was. Mr. J. Lomond, Esquire. I stood before the buzzer examining the letters. They were written neatly but artistically in classic black ink on thick white paper. It was so him. It seemed unlikely that he, a popular, handsome man with a world at his feet, would be at home on a Saturday night, so just to see how it felt, I gently touched his buzzer with the tip of my index finger. There was a crackle, and then a man's voice spoke. I was somewhat taken aback, to say the least.
"Hello?"
he said again. A deep voice, well-spoken, measured. Honey and smoke, velvet and silver. I quickly scanned the list and selected another resident's name at random. "Pizza delivery for McFadden?" I said.
I heard him sigh. "They're on the top floor," he said, and hung up.
The door buzzed and clicked open. Without stopping to think too much about it, I went inside. The musician was upstairs on the first floor, in the flat on the right-hand side. There was a discreet brass nameplate above the bell. I stood and listened. I could hear nothing from inside, just the hum of the stairlight and faint sounds from the street below. On the floor above, a television was blaring. I took out my notebook and tore off a blank page. I placed it over the nameplate and took out my pencil, then began a brass rubbing. Within moments, I had a stunning facsimile of the plate, which I placed carefully into my bag between the pages of the notebook. The exterior doors were open, and his interior door, a typical Victorian design of mahogany and opaque etched glass, was tantalizingly close. I stood as near as I dared. I could hear nothing from within, and there was no visible movement. I could almost make out the shape of a bookcase and a painting. A cultured man. How much we had in common. I stiffened. There. Soft fingers on vibrating steel, and a cord shimmered into the air, nebulous and milky like light from an old, old star. A voice. Warm and low and gentle. A voice to cast spells, charm snakes, shape the course of dreams. I could do nothing but turn towards it and lean closer. I pressed myself against the glass. He was writing a song, working it all out. Words, music, feelings. What a rare privilege to be permitted to eavesdrop on the very moment of creation. He sang of nature, my handsome Orpheus. His voice! I tipped my head back and closed my eyes. I pictured a sky. It was blue-black, soft and dense as fur. Across and over the expanse of night, into the velvet depths of it, light was scattered, enough for 1,000 darknesses. Patterns revealed themselves. The eye, exquisitely dazzled, sought out snail-shell walls and shattered pearls, gods and beasts and planets. As we stood still, yet we rotated, and whilst turning moved in a larger circle, round and round the sun, and oh, the dizzying momentum of it! The music stopped, and there was a sudden blurry movement. I stepped back and quickly started to walk upstairs, my heart hammering. Nothing. I stood on the upper landing and waited for a few minutes. Nothing. I tiptoed down and placed myself outside his door again. The music had started up once more, but I did not wish to disturb him. I was only there to see where he lived, after all. There was no harm in looking. Mission accomplished. It was sheer spendthrift madness, but once on the street I hailed a passing black cab to take me home. The evening had lingered slowly, but now it was definitely night, and I did not care to be abroad. The dark is where bad things happen. I estimated that the taxi was likely to cost in the region of £6, but I had no choice. I put on my seat belt and closed the glass panel that separated me from the driver. I had no desire to hear his views on association football, the city council, or any other topic. I had only one thing on my mind, or, more accurately, one person. I realized, after an hour or two, that I wasn't going to be able to sleep after my earlier adventuring. I put on the light and looked down at my nightdress. I have two, to allow for alternate washing.
They are identical, both of them ankle-length with a high neckline made of cosy brushed cotton. They're lemon-coloured. The shade reminds me of explosively fizzy boiled sweets. Not a feature of my early childhood, but a comforting image nonetheless. When I was young, for a treat, Mummy would pop a pimento-stuffed olive into my mouth, or occasionally an oily anchovy from a coffin-shaped yellow and red tin. She always stressed to me that sophisticated palates erred towards savoury flavours, that cheap sugary treats were the ruin of the poor and their teeth. Mummy always had very sharp, very white teeth. The only acceptable sweet treats, she said, were proper Belgian truffles. Neuhaus, nom de Dieu, only tourists bought those nasty chocolate seashells, or plump medjool dates from the souks of Tunis, both of which were rather difficult to source in our local spa. There was a time, shortly before the incident, when she shopped only at Fortnum's, and I recall that in that same period she was in regular correspondence with Fauchon over perceived imperfections in their confiture de cerise. I remember the pretty red stamps on the letters from Paris. Liberté, égalité, fraternité. Not exactly a credo of Mummy's. I folded my pillow in half to support me as I sat up. Sleep still felt far away and I was in need of soothing. I reached down into the gap between the mattress and the wall and sought my old faithful, its edges rounded and softened with years of handling. Jane Eyre. I could open up the novel at any page and immediately know where I was in the story, could almost visualise the next sentence before I reached it. It was an old Penguin classic, Miss Bronte's portrait gracing the cover. The bookplate inside read, St. Eustace Parish Church Sunday School, presented to Eleanor Oliphant for perfect attendance, 1998. I had a very ecumenical upbringing, all told, having been fostered by Presbyterians, Anglicans, Catholics, Methodists and Quakers, plus a few individuals who wouldn't recognise God if he pointed his electric Michelangelo finger at them. I submitted to all attempts at spiritual education with equally bad grace. Sunday school, or its equivalent, did at least get me out of whatever house I was living in, and sometimes there were sandwiches, or, more rarely, tolerable companions. I opened the book at random in the manner of a lucky dip. It fell open at a pivotal scene, the one where Jane meets Mr. Rochester for the first time, startling his horse in the woods and causing him to fall. Pilot is there too, the handsome, soulful-eyed hound. If the book has one failing, it's that there is insufficient mention of Pilot. You can't have too much dog in a book. Jane Eyre. A strange child, difficult to love. A lonely, only child. She is left to deal with so much pain at such a young age. The aftermath of death, the absence of love. It's Mr. Rochester who gets burned in the end. I know how that feels. All of it. Everything seems worse in the darkest hours of the night. I was surprised to hear that the birds were still singing, although they sounded angry. The poor creatures must hardly sleep in summer when the light glimmers on and on. In the half-dark, in the full dark, I remember. I remember. Awake in the shadows, two little rabbit heartbeats, breath like a knife. I remember. I remember. I closed my eyes. Eyelids are really just flesh curtains. Your eyes are always on, always looking. When you close them, you're watching the thin, veined skin of your inner eyelid rather than staring out at the world. It's not a comforting thought. In fact, if I thought about it for long enough, I'd probably want to pluck out my own eyes, to stop looking, to stop seeing all the time. The things I've seen cannot be unseen. The things I've done cannot be undone. Think about something nice, one of my foster parents would say when I couldn't sleep, or on nights when I woke up sweating, sobbing, screaming. Trite advice, but occasionally effective. So I thought about Pilot, the dog.
I suppose I must have slept. It seems impossible that I wouldn't have dropped off for at least a moment or two, but it didn't feel like it. Sundays are dead days. I tried to sleep as long as possible to pass the time, an old prison trick apparently, thank you for the tip, Mummy, but on summer mornings it can be difficult. When the phone rang just after 10, I'd been up for hours. I'd cleaned the bathroom and washed the kitchen floor, taken out the recycling and arranged all the tins in the cupboard so that the labels were facing forwards in zetabetical order. I'd polished both pairs of shoes. I'd read the newspaper and completed all the crosswords and puzzles. I cleared my throat before I spoke, realizing that I hadn't uttered a word for almost 12 hours, back when I told the taxi driver where to drop me off. That's actually quite good for me. Usually I don't speak from the point at which I state my destination to the bus driver on Friday night, right through until I greet his colleague on Monday morning.
Eleanor?
It was Raymond, of course. Yes, this is she, I said quite curtly. For goodness sake, who did he expect? He coughed extravagantly. Filthy smoker.
Right. I just wanted to let you know that I'm going in to see Sammy again today. Wondered if you wanted to come with me?
Why? I said. He paused for quite a while. Strange, it was hardly a difficult question.
Well, I phoned the hospital and he's much better. He's awake and he's been moved into the general medical ward. I suppose it'd be nice if he met us in case he had any questions about what happened to him.
I wasn't thinking very quickly and had no time to consider the ramifications. Before I quite knew what had happened, we'd arranged to meet at the hospital that afternoon. I hung up and looked at the clock on the living room wall, above the fireplace. It's the one I got in the Red Cross shop. Electric blue circular frame, power ranges. Adds a kind of rakish joie de vivre to the living room, I've always thought. I had several hours until the rendezvous. I decided to take my time getting ready, and looked cautiously at myself in the mirror while the shower warmed up. Could I ever become a musician's muse, I wondered. What was a muse, anyway? I was familiar with the classical illusion, of course, but in modern-day practical terms, a muse simply seemed to be an attractive woman whom the artist wanted to sleep with. I thought about all those paintings. Voluptuous maidens reclining in curvaceous splendour, waif-like ballerinas with huge limpid eyes, drowned beauties in clinging white gowns surrounded by floating blossoms. I was neither curvaceous nor waif-like. I was normal-sized and normal-faced. On one side, anyway. Did men ever look in the mirror, I wondered, and find themselves wanting in deeply fundamental ways? When they opened a newspaper or watched a film, were they presented with nothing but exceptionally handsome young men, and did this make them feel intimidated, inferior, because they were not as young, not as handsome? Did they then read newspaper articles ridiculing those same handsome men if they gained weight or wore something unflattering? These were, of course, rhetorical questions. I looked at myself again. I was healthy and my body was strong. I had a brain that worked fine and a voice, albeit an unmelodious one. Smoke inhalation all those years ago had damaged my vocal cords irreparably. I had hair, ears, eyes, and a mouth. I was a human woman, no more and no less. Even the circus freak side of my face, my damaged half, was better than the alternative, which would have meant death by fire. I didn't burn to ashes. I emerged from the flames like a little phoenix. I ran my fingers over the scar tissue, caressing the contours. I didn't burn, Mummy, I thought. I walked through the fire, and I lived. There are scars on my heart, just as thick, as disfiguring as those on my face. I know they're there. I hope some undamaged tissue remains, a patch through which love can come in and flow out. I hope. Chapter 9. Raymond was waiting outside the front door of the hospital. I saw him bend down to light the cigarette of a woman in a wheelchair. She brought her drip out with her, on wheels, so that she could destroy her health at the same time as taxpayers' money was being used to try and restore it. Raymond chatted to her as she smoked, puffing away himself. He leaned forward and said something, and the woman laughed, a harridan's cackle that ended in a prolonged bout of coughing. I approached with caution, fearing the noxious cloud might envelop me to deleterious effect. He spotted me coming, stubbed out his cigarette, then ambled towards me. He was wearing a pair of denim trousers which were slung unpleasantly low around his buttocks. When his back was turned, I saw an unwelcome inch of underpant, a ghastly imperial purple, and white skin covered in freckles, reminding me of a giraffe's hide.
"Hiya, Eleanor,"
he said, rubbing his hands on the front of his thighs as though to clean them.
"How are you doing today?"
Horrifically, he leaned forward as though to embrace me. I stepped back, but not before I had a chance to smell the cigarette smoke and another odour, something unpleasantly chemical and pungent. I suspected it was an inexpensive brand of gentleman's cologne.
"Good afternoon, Raymond," I said. "Shall we go inside?"
We took the lift towards 7. Raymond recounted the events of the previous evening to me at tedious length. He and his friends had apparently pulled a late one, whatever that meant, completing a mission on Grand Theft Auto and then playing poker. I wasn't sure why he was telling me this. I certainly hadn't asked. He finally finished speaking and then inquired about my evening.
"I conducted some research," I said, not wishing to sully the experience by recounting it to Raymond.
"Look," I said, "Ward 7. Like a child or a small pet, he was easily distracted, and we took turns to use the alcohol hand rub before we went in. Safety first, although my poor ravaged skin had barely recovered from the previous dermatological onslaught. Sammy was in the last bed nearest to the window, reading the Sunday Post. He glared at us over the top of his spectacles as we approached. His demeanour was not friendly. Raymond cleared his throat.
"Hi there, Mr. Tom," he said. "I'm Raymond, and this is Eleanor."
I nodded at the old man. Raymond kept talking.
We found you when you had your funny turn, and I went with you in the ambulance to hospital. We wanted to come by today and say hello, and see how you were doing."
I leaned forward and extended my hand. Sammy stared at it.
"Eh?"
he said.
"Who did you say you were?"
He looked quite perturbed and not a little aggressive. Raymond started to explain again, but Sammy held up his hand, palm facing forward, to silence him. Given that he was wearing candy-striped pyjamas and his white hair was as fluffy and spiky as a baby pigeon's, he nevertheless cut a surprisingly assertive figure.
"Now hold on, wait a minute,"
he said, and leaned towards his bedside cabinet, grabbing something from the shelf. I took an involuntary step back. Who knew what he might be about to pull out of there? He inserted something into his ear and fiddled about for a moment, a high-pitched squeal emitting from that side of his head. It stopped, and he smiled.
"Right then," he said. "That's better. Now the dog can see the rabbi. So what's the story with you, Pear? Church, is it? Or are you trying to rent me a telly again? I don't want one, son. I've already told your pals. There's no way I'm paying good money just to lie here and watch all that shite. Fatties doing ballroom dancing, grown men baking cakes, for the love of God."
Raymond cleared his throat again and repeated his introduction, while I leaned forward and shook Sammy's hand. His expression changed instantly, and he beamed at us both.
"Oh, so it was you, Pear, was it? I kept asking the nurses who it was that had saved my life. Who brought me in? I said, how did I get here? But they couldn't tell me. Well, have a seat. Come on, sit down next to me and tell me all about yourselves. I can't thank you enough for what you did. I really can't."
He nodded, and then his face became very serious.
"All you hear these days is that everything's going to hell in a handcart, how everybody's a paedophile or a crook, and it's no true.
You forget that the world is full of ordinary, decent people like yourselves. Good Samaritans who'll stop and help a soul in need. Just wait till the family meet you. They'll be over the moon, so they will.
He leaned back on his pillows, tired out from the effort of talking. Raymond fetched me a plastic seat, then another for himself.
How are you feeling then, Mr. Tom?
Raymond asked him.
Did you have a good night?
Call me Sammy, son. There's no need to stand on ceremony. I'm doing fine, thanks. I'll be right as rain in no time. You and your wife here saved my life, though no two ways about it.
I felt Raymond shift in his chair and I leaned forward.
Mr. Tom, I said.
He raised his eyebrows, then waggled them at me in quite a disconcerting way.
Sammy, I said, correcting myself, and he nodded at me. I'm afraid I have to clarify a couple of factual inaccuracies, I said. Firstly, we did not save your life. Credit for that must go to the ambulance service, whose staff, although somewhat brusque, did what was necessary to stabilize your condition whilst they brought you here. The medical team at the hospital, including the anaesthetist and the orthopaedic surgeon who operated on your hip, alongside the many other healthcare professionals who have carried out your post-operative care, it is they who saved you, if anyone did. Raymond and I merely summoned assistance and kept you company until such time as the National Health Service took responsibility.
Aye, God bless the NHS, right enough, said Raymond,
interrupting rudely. I gave him one of my sternest looks. Furthermore, I continued, I should clarify post-haste that Raymond and myself are merely co-workers. We are most certainly not married to one another. I stared hard at Sammy, making sure that he was in no doubt. Sammy looked at Raymond. Raymond looked at Sammy. There was a silence which, to me, seemed slightly awkward. Raymond sat forward in his chair.
So, where'd you live then, Sammy? What were you up to the other day when you had your accident?
He asked.
Sammy smiled at him. I'm local, son. Born and bred, he said. I always get my bits and pieces from the shops on a Friday. I'd been feeling a bit funny that morning, right enough, but I thought it was just my angina. Never expected to find myself in here.
He took a toffee from a large bag on his lap, then offered them to us. Raymond took one. I declined. The thought of malleable confectionery, warm to body temperature on Sammy's groin, albeit encased in flannel pyjamas and a blanket, was repellent. Both Sammy and Raymond were audible masticators. While they chomped, I looked at my hands, noticing that they looked raw, almost burnt, but glad of the fact that the alcohol rub had removed the germs and bacteria which lurked everywhere in the hospital, and, presumably, on me.
What about you two? Did you have far to come today?
Sammy asked.
Separately, I mean.
He added quickly, looking at me.
Well, I live on the south side, Raymond said. And Eleanor's, you're in the West End, aren't you?
I nodded, not wishing to disclose my place of residence any more precisely. Sammy asked about work, and I let Raymond tell him, being content to observe. Sammy looked rather vulnerable, as people are wont to do when they are wearing pyjamas in public, but he was younger than I'd originally thought. Not more than 70, I'd guess, with remarkably dark blue eyes.
I don't know anything about graphic design, Sammy said.
It sounds very fancy. I was a postman all my days. I got out at the right time, though. I can live on my pension so long as I'm careful. It's all changed now. I'm glad I'm not there anymore. All the messing about they've done with it. In my day, it was a proper public service.
Raymond was nodding.
That's right, he said. Remember when you used to get your post before you left the house in the morning, and there was a lunchtime delivery too? It comes in the middle of the afternoon now, if it comes at all.
I have to admit, I was finding the post office chat somewhat tedious.
How long are you likely to be in here, Sammy? I said. I only ask because the chances of contracting a post-operative infection are significantly increased for longer-stay patients. Gastroenteritis, Staphylococcus aureus, Clostridium difficile.
Raymond interrupted me again.
Aye, he said, and I bet the food's rank as well, eh, Sammy?
Sammy laughed.
You're no wrong there, son, he said.
You want to see what they served up for lunch today? Supposed to be Irish stew, looked more like pedigree chum, smelled like it too.
Raymond smiled.
Can we get you anything, Sammy? We could nip to the shop downstairs or else pop back late in the week, bring stuff in if you need it.
Raymond looked at me for confirmation and I nodded. I had no reason to dismiss the suggestion. It was actually quite a pleasant feeling, thinking that I might be able to help an elderly person who was suffering due to inadequate nutrition. I started to think about what to bring him, types of food that could be transported without mishap. I wondered if Sammy might enjoy some cold pasta and pesto. I could make a double portion for supper one evening and bring the leftovers to him the next day in a Tupperware tub. I did not own any Tupperware, having had no need of it until this point. I could go to a department store to purchase some. That seemed to be the sort of thing that a woman of my age and social circumstances might do. Exciting.
Ach, son, that's awful kind of you,
Sammy said, deflating my sense of purpose somewhat.
But there's really no need. The family are in here every day, twice a day.
He said this last part with evident pride.
I can't even finish half the stuff they bring. There's just so much of it. I end up having to give most of it away,
he said, indicating the other men on the ward with an imperious wave of his hand. What constitutes your family? I asked, slightly surprised by this revelation. I had assumed you were single and childless like us. Raymond shifted uncomfortably in his seat.
I'm a widower, Eleanor, Sammy said. Jean died 5 years ago. Cancer. Took her quick in the end.
He paused and sat up straighter.
I've two sons and a daughter. Keith's my eldest, married with two wee ones. They're cheeky monkeys, those boys, he said, his eyes crinkling.
Gary's my other son, Gary and Michelle. They're not married, but they live together. Well, that seems to be the way of it these days. And Laura, my youngest, well, God knows about Laura, divorced twice by the age of 35, can you believe it? She's got her own wee business, a nice house and a car. She just can't seem to find a good man. Or when she does find one, she can't hang on to him.
I found this interesting. I'd counsel your daughter not to worry, I said with confidence. In my recent experience, the perfect man appears when you're least expecting it. Fate throws him into your path, and then Providence ensures that you will end up together. Raymond made a strange sound, something between a cough and a sneeze. Sammy smiled kindly at me.
Is that right? Well, you can tell her yourself, hen, he said. They'll all be here soon.
A nurse walked past as he said this and had clearly overheard. She was grossly overweight and was wearing rather attractive white plastic clogs teamed with striking black and yellow striped socks. Her feet looked like big, fat wasps. I made a mental note to ask her where she'd purchased them before we left. There's a maximum of 3 visitors to a bed, she said, and we're strictly enforcing that rule today, I'm afraid. She didn't look afraid. Raymond stood up.
We'll go and let your family visit, Sammy, he said.
I stood up too. It seemed appropriate.
No rush, no rush now, Sammy said.
Shall we return later in the week? I asked. Is there a magazine or a periodical you'd like us to bring?
Eleanor, it's like I said. You two saved my life. We're family now. Come and visit any time you like. I'd love to see you, hen, Sammy said.
His eyes were damp like periwinkles in seawater. I held out my hand again, and instead of shaking it, he clasped both of mine in his. Normally I would be horrified, but he surprised me. His hands were large and warm, like an animal's paws, and mine felt small and fragile inside them. His fingernails were quite long and gnarly, and there were curly grey hairs on the backs of his hands, running all the way up and under his pyjama sleeves.
Eleanor, listen,
he said, staring me in the eye and gripping my hands tightly.
Thanks again, lass. Thanks for taking care of me and bringing in my shopping.
I found that I didn't want to remove my hands from the warmth and strength of his. Raymond coughed, his lungs no doubt reacting to the absence of carcinogens over the last half hour or so. I swallowed hard, suddenly finding it difficult to speak.
"I'll return later in the week, then, with comestibles," I said eventually. "I promise."
Sammy nodded.
"Cheers then, big man," Raymond said, placing
a meaty hand on Sammy's shoulder.
"See you soon, eh?"
Sammy waved to us as we made our way out of the ward, and was still waving and smiling as we turned the corner and headed towards the lift. Neither of us spoke until we got outside.
"What a lovely guy, eh?"
Raymond said, somewhat redundantly. I nodded, trying to hold on to the feeling of my hands in his, cozy and safe, and the look of kindness and warmth in his eyes. I found, to my extreme consternation, that nascent tears were forming in my eyes, and I turned away to rub them before they could spill over. Annoyingly, Raymond, usually the least observant of men, had noticed.
"What are you doing for the rest of the day, Eleanor?"
Raymond asked gently. I looked at my watch. It was almost 4. "I suppose I'll return home. Perhaps read for a while," I said. "There's a radio program on later where people write in to request excerpts of items they've enjoyed during the week. That can often be reasonably entertaining." I was also thinking that I might buy some more vodka, just a half bottle, to top up what remained. I yearned for that brief, sharp feeling I'd get when I drink it, a sad, burning feeling, and then, blissfully, no feelings at all. I'd also seen the date on Sammy's newspaper, and remembered that today was, in fact, my birthday. Annoyingly, I'd forgotten to ask the nurse where she'd purchased her wasp socks. Those could have been my present to myself. I decided that I might buy some freesias instead. I've always loved their delicate scent and the softness of their colours. They have a kind of subdued luminosity which is much more beautiful than a garish sunflower or a clichéd red rose. Raymond was looking at me.
"I'm going to my mum's now," he said.
I nodded, blew my nose and zipped up my jerkin in preparation for the journey home.
"Listen, do you fancy coming with me?"
Raymond said, just as I was turning towards the gate. Under no circumstances, was my immediate thought.
"I go over most Sundays," he went on. "She doesn't get out much. I'm sure she'd love to see a new face."
"Even one like mine," I said. I couldn't imagine that anyone would take any particular pleasure in looking at my face, either for the first or for the thousand and first time. Raymond ignored me and began to rummage in his pockets. I thought about his suggestion while he lit up another cigarette. I could still purchase vodka and birthday flowers on the way home, after all, and it might be interesting to see the inside of another person's home. I tried to think of the last time I had done so. I had stood in the hallway of my downstairs neighbour's flat a couple of years ago, when I was delivering a parcel I'd taken in for them. The place had smelled strongly of onions, and there was an ugly standard lamp in the corner. A few years before that, one of the receptionists had hosted a party at her flat and invited all the women from work. It was a beautiful flat, a traditional tenement with stained glass and mahogany and elaborate cornices. The party, however, had merely been a pretext, a ruse of sorts, to provide her with the opportunity to attempt to sell us sex toys. It was a most unedifying spectacle. 17 drunken women comparing the efficacy of a range of alarmingly large vibrators. I left after 10 minutes, having downed a tepid glass of Pinot Grigio and parried an outrageously impertinent question from a cousin of the host about my private life. I'm familiar with the concept of bacchanalia and Dionysian revels, of course, but it strikes me as utterly bizarre that women should want to spend an evening together drinking and purchasing such items, and indeed that this should pass as entertainment. sexual union between lovers should be a sacred, private thing. It should not be a topic for discussion with strangers over a display of edible underwear. When the musician and I spent our first night together, the joining of our bodies would mirror the joining of our minds, our souls. His otherness, the flash of dark hair in his armpit, the buttons of bone at his clavicle, the blood scent in the crook of his elbow, the warm softness of his lips as he takes me in his arms and...
Eleanor? Hello? I was just saying, we'll need to go now to catch the bus if you're coming to Mum's.
I dragged myself back to the unwelcome present and the squat figure of Raymond, with his grubby hooded sweatshirt and dirty training shoes. Perhaps Raymond's mother would prove intelligent and charming company. I doubted it, based on the evidence of her progeny, but one never knew.
Yes, Raymond, I will accompany you to your mother's house, I said.
Chapter 10. Of course Raymond didn't have a car. I would guess he was in his mid-30s, but there was something adolescent, not fully formed about him. It was partly the way he dressed, of course. I had yet to see him in normal leather footwear. He wore training shoes at all times, and seemed to own a wide range of colours and styles. I have often noticed that people who routinely wear sportswear are the least likely sort to participate in athletic activity. Sport is a mystery to me. In primary school, sports day was the one day of the year when the less academically gifted students could triumph, winning prizes for jumping fastest in a sack or running from point A to point B more quickly than their classmates. How they loved to wear those badges on their blazers the next day, as if a silver in the egg and spoon race was some sort of compensation for not understanding how to use an apostrophe. At secondary school, PE was simply unfathomable. We had to wear special clothes and then run endlessly around a field, occasionally being told to hold a metal tube and pass it to someone else. If we weren't running, we were jumping into a sandpit or over a small bar on legs. There was a special way of doing this. You couldn't simply run and jump. You had to do some strange sort of hop and skip first. I asked why, but none of the PE teachers, most of whom, as far as I could ascertain, would struggle to tell you the time, could furnish me with an answer. All of these seemed strange activities to impose on young people with no interest in them, and indeed I'm certain that they merely served to alienate the majority of us from physical activity for life. Fortunately, I am naturally lithe and elegant of limb, and I enjoy walking, so I have always kept myself in a reasonable state of physical fitness. Mummy has a particular loathing for the overweight. "Creepy, lazy beast," she'd hiss, if one waddled past us in the street, and I may perhaps have internalized this view to some extent. Raymond wasn't overweight, but he was doughy and a bit paunchy. None of his muscles were visible, and I suspect he only ever used the ones in his forearms with any degree of regularity. His sartorial choices did not flatter his unprepossessing physique. Slouchy denims, baggy T-shirts with childish slogans and images. He dressed like a boy rather than a man. His toilette was sloppy too, and he was usually unshaven. It was not a beard as such, but patchy stubble, which merely served to make him look unkempt. His hair, a mousy, dirty blonde, was cut short and had been given minimal attention, at most perhaps a rub with a grubby towel after washing. The overall impression was of a man who, whilst not exactly a vagrant, had certainly slept rough in a flop house or on a stranger's floor the previous evening. "Here's our bus, Eleanor," Raymond said, nudging me rudely. I had my travel pass ready, but typically Raymond did not possess one, preferring to pay well over the odds for want of a moment's advance planning. He did not, it transpired, even have the correct change, and so I had to lend him a pound. I would be sure to recoup it at work tomorrow. The journey to his mother's house took about 20 minutes, during which I explained the benefits of a travel pass to him,
including where one could purchase such an item, and how many journeys one needed to take in order to break even, or indeed to effectively travel for free. He did not seem particularly interested, and didn't even thank me when I'd finished. He is a spectacularly unsophisticated conversationalist. We walked through a small estate of square white homes,